hypothermia and burns is not that great for the patient. Think of them as a trauma patient, yes, but also if the body is compensating for the trauma, one of the mechanisms for compensation and shock is to shunt blood to the core from the periphery. It's great for the core who lives there, heart, brain, lungs, important organs. Woo-woo, this is fantastic. Unfortunately, who's on the periphery? That's the skin, which is exactly who we're concerned with in burns.
Here you on 8. Here you on 8. Okay, you're clear. Stand by for your base.
Welcome back to EMS Cast, where we provide high-level education for you, the providers on the streets. As a reminder, this is part 2 of our 2-part series on burns. If you haven't already, go back and listen to part 1, where we set the stage for the important early steps in management of these burn patients. In this episode, we're going to simplify our approach to fluids in these patients, and we're also going to address some of the nuances of care, such as vascular access, heat loss, burn center transfer criteria, and electrocution injuries. Let's jump back into our discussion with Will Berry and Derek Miller.
So I want to bring us back to our case and our process, right? So we've our depth for our down and dirty initial management, deeper than first degree, measuring our total body surface area. We've got multiple tools in the toolbox, but rule of nines, palmar surface, we're going to get in the ballpark. Okay, we feel like we have an accurate TBSA, and it's not just so we sound good on our like biophone or encode to the emergency room. We're like ready to do something with that.
Sure.
So like, how does it impact care? Why does it, how do we use that to get our fluid?
Yeah, so.
And how do we use it without having to get a calculator out?
Great question. Well, if you do it enough times, you kind of have some of it's some automaticity that's in your brain,
but we don't. These are rare calls.
Yeah. So, and I love that you called me out on that because that is the conundrum, right? If I'm seeing, you know, hundreds of patients a year, I'm just get native to doing that, right?
Well, but, and we get, I think in a, on a 911 ambulance, it's a burn call is not a super frequent call, but a critical burn patient, this greater than 20% total body surface area, that's not common.
Yeah. No, it's an excellent point. So, and again, I don't think I can emphasize this enough, the priorities of care with a real world perspective, I think burn centers would do well to fully appreciate that it's a different ball game when you're pre-hospital and you're dealing with all comers and you might see one critical burn a year, maybe, right? And so how do we bridge that gap of...
Well, and you're also seeing, you know, thinking back to my time on an ambulance, there are those like slam dunk ones where I had a guy... whose vehicle's gas tank erupted and coated him in flaming gasoline.
Sure.
That's a, you know, yeah, critical burn, right? I also had a woman working in a restaurant kitchen who had a pan of hot grease dumped down her, like basically from her neck to her navel. And you're like, I don't know if this needs, you know, I really need to get in there and assess this because I don't know if the burn center is the most appropriate or not. I think we kind of fall back to, well, just take her there because they're the pros. But there's the slam dunk. There's the, oh, yeah, they just have a isolated burn somewhere. And then there's a lot of in between, too.
Yeah. No, it's a whole lot of gray. So separate from fluid resuscitation and separate from burn mapping, but related, I think. So the ABA has what's called referral criteria. I think most people maybe have heard the term. But to your point, like there are certain things that we know. Wow, 90% burn with blah, blah, blah. You know, yep, no doubt. So just to take some of the edge off, the burn centers, you know, because I have friendly relations and I have gone to teach at other burn centers, et cetera. We, you know, it's a relatively small group of us who do that. So we try to all help each other. You know, there are burn centers that say, hey, you know, give us a call. tell us what you see, we'll tell you what we think. And sometimes the right answer for everybody is, you know, here's what you can do to treat that in that ED that's 4 hours away. Or, you know, maybe you do want that to be seen, but you don't need to come by ambulance in the middle of the night right now. You can come, you know, in a day or two to our outpatient clinic because we got that too, etc. So I would say let there be a low bar for referring agencies, whether they be EMS or outside hospital ED or whatever it is, to, you know, to develop that consult referral relationship so that the right choice can be made to supplement good clinical skills in the field. And again, to your point, when it's a slam dunk, yes, you do the life-saving stuff, on they go. Everybody knows that. But for that middle gray area, just don't feel bad, or let there be no barriers to reaching out to your local burn center. Obviously, I'm biased. I work at UNC, but we feel the same for other burn centers as well. Folks, they want their surrounding communities to feel comfortable reaching out for consultation to then decide, is this an appropriate patient for triage and transfer now versus later, or here's how you treat them and treat them.
So back to our case.
Yes, sir.
We're feeling good about the total body surface area we've arrived at.
Mm-hmm.
We're feeling good about depth, or, you know, what's over the line, what's under the line.
Mm-hmm.
So how are we getting our number of mLs of fluid we need to give?
Yeah, good question. So if we can imagine in your scenario, and I'm asking because I wasn't on your call, and I don't ride, I don't fly. I've talked to a lot of folks who do, so I can make educated guesses, but on the call that you described with the lady with the flammable liquid, how long after your arrival on scene would you say you had a good number in your head that you felt confident with?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. And were you already rolling and or flying by that time?
I would say, let me back up. I would say I arrived at my number at the 5 minute mark.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were in the process of packaging and loading for another 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes.
Sure. So this is nominally 10 minutes in, as you say. So in the spirit of good, better, best, we want you to be able to do some maths, as it were, using where we're at now with some version of Parkland, which I'll explain. But what we really want folks to be comfortable with is recognizing this is a clinically significant burn. I think it meets that 20% threshold. I know burn shock is progressive and happens over hours. So I'm going to go ahead and get some access and start some fluids now. The good news is, because I'm not bolusing as a general rule, and because I know this is progressive over hours, if I'm off by a little bit, the stakes are not catastrophic if I'm off by a little bit, because I'm not trying to get 5 liters in my ride, as an example. I can tweak this as I refine my estimate. So since I want to say around 2015, the ABA said, look, we know it's extremely hard for the initial touch, for those folks touching patients initially, to get good estimates, to feel good about it. And they're doing multiple other things. So if in your estimate, it's a clinically significant burn, which nominally 20% or greater, then the next question is, well, which bucket do you fit in? Which tier, which category, 1, 2, or 3? For garden variety adults, start them at 500 an hour. So 500 cc's an hour, we'll put in the caveat. We prefer lactated ringers. I know there's a lot of EMS services out there that may only have normal saline on the truck, and that's fine. Initially, hypovolemia is worse than hyperchloremic acidosis, which we'll talk about that if we have time. So bucket number one, you're an adult with a significant burn. You're going to get 500 an hour of LR. That's what we advise. You don't have to do extra crazy math. Here's your 500 an hour, with the understanding that we'll tweak that a little bit later when I have a better sense of what's happening. Door number two. Well, you're not an adult, you're a kid. Well, what kind of kid? If you're nominally school-aged, which we'll say 6 to 13, we're going to give you $2.50 an hour. And if you're a tiny human, from birth up to 5 years, we're going to give you $1.25 an hour.
I like this math.
That's good. So the beauty of it is there's less math, right? There's a lot more pressure to be taken off. Because again, what we know, if I'm off on the TBSA, if I'm off guesstimating weight, or if while trying to multitask, drop a tube, get an IV while my partner's hitting every speed bump or whatever, you want me to do maths while I'm whatever. It's not a reasonable ask if I want finely tuned results. So in those first X minutes during my load and go, again, during my primary survey, if you will, you're clinically burned. The next question is, well, are you an adult? Are you an older kid? Or are you a younger kid? It's two questions to ask, really. So again, to summarize, garden variety adult burns, 500 cc's an hour. We prefer LR. Older kids, nominally, 6 to 13. And then if you're younger than that, 125 an hour.
Simple enough.
We want it to help folks, because the pitfalls is folks are intimidated. And we've seen this happen. Folks are intimidated by the math. Well, we'll just let them figure that out in the ED. So then 45 minutes later or whatever, however long the transport is, however long they fiddle fart around in the ED is, and then an hour goes by and they've gotten no fluid. So then we're behind the eight ball. So we want to demystify, take some of the edge off to make it, you know, less threatening for the practitioner. The other end of the spectrum is people do some maths but get it wrong. Plenty of opportunities to get it wrong, forget to divide the first half by the first date or whatever, and they end up at a burn center, whatever, an hour later, and they've gotten 3 liters of fluid. And we're like, what? So
what about access?
Oh,
so
sure.
I read an article preparing for this about IO.
Yeah.
Administering fluid and pain management through an IO in severe burn patients.
Yeah.
But also just, I've also been in situations where we've had to establish IV access through the burned tissue.
Yeah.
Do you have pearls of wisdom or guidance on how we get our access?
Yeah. So
initially,
first off, I'd love to, anything gleaned from that article that you'd like to chime in, I'd love to hear what this article was. I can tell you my thoughts, but
it was a pretty small cohort of patients, just because I think they were so catastrophically burned.
Sure.
But it was in the ABA's journal, so it seemed very reputable. And I think the gist of it was an IO was sufficient.
Yeah, concur wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
And I'll just interrupt there for a second. I think it was not only adequate, but I think that paper you're referencing, Will, you sent it to me, actually showed that IO led to faster access and better fluid and pain management administration.
I think it's a good point, if I can chime in on that.
Yeah, like, please.
Same but different. I mean, this is so great. So literally was having a conversation with my buddy Paul, a longtime CICU nurse, and at UNC, the CICU charge nurse is the de facto code team nurse, and they're the only inpatient nurses who drill, who place IOs. And, you know, he just loves them because you don't have to fiddle fart around with, you know, and again, please don't misunderstand, not all burn patients are coding. We're talking about two different things here, but the beauty of IOs, if you know what you're doing, boom, you're in, we're done. We don't have to look, can I, you know, through burned tissue? Well, how about the other arm? Can I find it here? Oh, they're burned there too. Well, now 2 minutes have gone by, all this kind of stuff. So I know, well, number one, follow your medical director's protocols. That must be said. But I know that there exist EMS services who don't even look for IVs. It's sorry that you're a trauma. Here's your IO. Moving on. Or there's the can't get one in 90 seconds or less. now we'll move on, whatever. But it's a great tool, and outcomes can be just as good because there's no delay. Great tool, great tool.
Is it problematic to establish IV access through burned tissue?
It absolutely can be. And of course, the deeper the burn, third degree burns, full thickness, i.e. eschar, it can be much harder to get through that because some of your tactile cues may not be there. You know, the finesse, the touch that you're used to when, you know, waiting for the angiocath to go through, et cetera, et cetera. So I cannot point to gold standard research, i.e. multi-center, placebo-controlled, randomized prospective multi-center trials, et cetera, to say how much harder is it to go through burn skin. I can say anecdotally it's true for myself and for many others. So it can be more difficult, but depending upon is the practitioner, are they comfortable with IOs? Not every person can drill. Did the last time they drill, was that at the skills fair 3 months ago? Or, you know, are they doing it frequently? So in a different sense, this goes back to our, which tool is the right tool? It's the one that you're good at, so to speak. But I would say have no qualms about switching gears to drill if you're comfortable doing that and are well practiced, versus wasting time trying to find the perfect spot to get an IV.
I like it. Continuing with our case, you've gotten us to a good place for our transport of this patient. So we've estimated our total body surface area and we're comfortable with the depth of it. We're going to go with the 500 milliliters an hour of ideally lactated ringers if it's available. Can you speak to that? I've worked in systems that only carried normal saline. Is that bad for these patients?
Yeah, so it's a matter of timing. And again, good, better, best. So when we look at what's being lost from the patient's intravascular space, that third spacing of plasma, and then what we would be replacing it with, the literature tends to suggest that LR is a closer match to the composition of what's being lost. For the first 30 minutes to an hour, and again, and I guess I should step back here. Not sure where to splice this in. I know this your EMS cast can be listened to those with discriminating tastes and excellent judgment anywhere. But let's agree that depending upon where my EMS service is, or if I'm, you know, like if I'm a rural rescue squad versus, you know, an urban EMS versus critical care ground versus critical care air, if I am here in the triangle, I can throw a rock and hit a trauma center, but that's different perhaps than if I'm in North Dakota and I have to go 3-4 states away to reach a burn center, so to speak. So the time variable, I think, is relevant. If this is an 11-minute ride to the ED for me versus 3 hours, maybe I'll feel differently about those two. So time matters, but broadly speaking, if we're talking 1-2 hours, 3 hours, normal saline is not a problem. It's after the 12th liter, so to speak, in the first 24 hours for a large burn. Then we start worrying about hypernatremia and hyperchloremia, which can lead to acidosis. And there's metadata to suggest that it does tend to lead to worse outcomes. Down the line, you're hemodynamically stable, but am I causing, you know, avoidable renal insult by that, et cetera, perhaps. So, but again, in the short run, 30-minute ride has a ballpark average of how long I'm with that patient. Hypovolemia is going to be a bigger threat than hyperchloremic acidosis.
Gotcha. So for me, thinking through this case, I'm feeling like I'm in a good spot. I've arrived at a total body surface area. I've got a fluid number in mind. But have I missed any pitfalls? Are there any types of burns where, obviously airway, we've talked about that, but are there any types of burns where I need to be doing more things that maybe I've overlooked? Classic example that I think a lot of people may be taught in paramedic school is if it's some sort of hot oil that can remain on the skin and continue to burn the patient.
Sure.
So you need to do something about that. What situations like that do we need to be aware of as first responders to these?
Fantastic. So, you know, we've honed in on the fluid resuscitation piece and those immediate life threats. But backing up just a hair, my priorities, let's agree, could be different if I'm the scene call versus doing an interfacility transport for a patient who's been hanging out in the ED somewhere else for 3 hours. But let's presume that I'm a scene call and this is relatively soon after the initial injury. Well, first off, of course, scene safety. Can't stress that enough. And that could be, sure, electrical line worker. Let's make sure the lines are de-energized. If this was an MVC, prolonged extrication. Let's make sure that, you know, traffic's rerouted so the texting driver doesn't clip me or my partner or whatever. More subtly, whatever's on them, right? Let's do a good quality field decon, right? And hopefully fire is involved as well. They're Johnny on the spot with that. But let's make sure that what's on them is not on me now or my partner, because what we don't know is that house fire they were in, well, it was a meth lab or whatever. Rinse and repeat. Pick something, right? So the scene safety piece, let non-trivial, right? Protecting everybody, including me, my partner, and my team. So if that is, if we've addressed that, I'm safe. Well, now, from a like bald bear perspective, if they're on fire, put them out, right? If it's not flame, it's trickier, right? So to your point about grease, something flammable, hot oil, well, it's going to stick and stay on there, right? So it's one of the reasons that we promote trauma naked. Again, the North Carolina isms. I'm sorry, Ross. Sorry to inflict that upon you, sir. But if it's some kind of contaminant, and, you know, maybe this is from a DuPont factory, and everybody knows there's chemical exposure here. A lot of times it's less obvious. We find out hours later, oh, yeah, the reason there was a fire because chemical A blew or whatever. One of the easiest way to decrease the contaminant load is you remove their clothes, right? That takes 90% of it off right there as a rule. So the other thing is, like, if the grease or whatever it is still on them, doing our level best to get anything that I can off of them, which brings us to some conflicting priorities. So most of us have heard this phrase of you want to cool a burn. Now, there's a variety of reasons to want to do that. And so it's important that if I'm the one doing it, that I have a clear rationale in my mind as to why I'm doing it.
Yeah, I've been taught that. I've been taught to aggressively cool a burn to the point of like massively almost submerging someone in water.
Sure. And to be fair, there are different schools of thought on this. I'll include some to kind of show some contrasting opinions. But even the contrasting opinion would agree we don't want a cold patient. So the problem, the rubber meets the road here, or the friction point becomes, I would like to cool the burn. At the same time, I don't want a cold patient. So probably everybody who's listening may have heard of the trauma triad of death, which of course we're bougie now. Now it's the diamond of death, right? We're going to add some more polygons here, I guess, eventually. But we know that hypothermia leads to bad things and kind of reinforces coagulopathy and acidosis. We'll add in again the hypocalcemia piece for extra credit, but that's true generically in trauma. Well, hypothermia and burns is not that great for the patient. Think of them as a trauma patient, yes, but also if the body is compensating for the trauma, one of the mechanisms for compensation and shock is to shunt blood to the core from the periphery. It's great for the core who lives there, heart, brain, lungs, important organs. Woo-woo, this is fantastic. Unfortunately, who's on the periphery? That's the skin, which is exactly who we're concerned with in burns.
And maybe the wound we're trying to help heal.
Yeah, absolutely, right? And so the skin focally is the organ first in mind when we think of burns, right? The skin is injured first. Now, what we know, you know, we could talk about this all day long too, the fantastically complex things about big burns is that every organ system is affected, but we see the burn to the skin, and we can start there. So if I'm making the skin cold, I could be cooling the patient, inducing trauma tri to death, of course, but I'm also inducing shunting of blood away from the skin, which means I'm exacerbating malperfusion. So, you know, we talked about how a burn wound can manifest over time and how it makes it tricky for the pre-hospital personnel, you know, to guess what is this going to look like 2 days from now. So part of that is, well, I want to do the things now that will make things not get worse, not be worse. You know, when I did my not so great description of depths of skin and what structures are in the dermal layer.
I tracked your 5 pieces of paper.
Oh, yeah.
20 pieces of paper.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. If we talk about like what's in the dermis that matters, I talked about stem cells and I talked about the surface blood vessels. And the reason that matters is even if the stem cell is alive, if it's not being perfused because of direct insult to the surface blood vessels, then the stem cell won't be alive tomorrow, right? Well, what else? Anything else that physiologically is going to blunt or impair or damage surface perfusion. And the two biggies are screwing up fluid resuscitation from making them hypovolemic or fluid overloaded, or making them cold, which is going to shunt blood away from the skin. So those are things that are cousins of our thought processes behind, I want to cool the burn, but I also want to make sure I don't have a cold patient.
Yeah, there's a tension there. So how do we,
boy,
do you have any practical tips for how can we cool some burns?
Sure.
Well, and I think it's important to note here too, right? We're talking about the like 20% or greater critically ill burn patient. For those smaller burns, like absolutely aggressively cool, because we're not going to worry about that hypothermia or those fluid shifts as much. So the smaller burns definitely cool aggressively. But yes, please talk to us about these critical large burns.
It's a great point, Ross. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, we think of those catastrophic injuries, but it's a gradient. It's a gradient. And so we can all relate to the far end of the continuum where it's, I've, you know, I touch something on the stove and I have a 0.25% burn to one finger. Sure. Run that under the kitchen sink tap water, you know, to cool that, both to limit the local, here's a key distinction, the local inflammation response versus that writ large systemic inflammation response we get when we're talking 20-30% burns. Something baked into blunting the injury itself, we have to talk about pain in this, because I think, at least in my experience, there's some muddy water in terms of why we're doing what we're doing. Some patients will tell you that cooling feels good, makes the pain less bad. It's interesting to me because I taught a class at a local community college and had, you know, room full of EMS personnel, gave my dog and pony show, my spiel, said all these things. And this fella came up, paramedic, and said he had been burned 30 years ago, badly burned. And he disagreed with everything that I said, because when they put cold water on him, that's the only thing that helped him feel better. It's the only thing that took away the pain. So I think it's important to talk about that. Now, I would argue, again, bravery of being out of range, but I would argue, well, if we are leaning heavily upon cool water or cool dressings to take away the pain, we probably haven't used, you know, our pharmacologic tools well enough. I mean, we got some better tools in the toolbox than cool water, right? Whether that's, you know, an opioid, whether that's ketamine, whatever, we got tools in there. But I think it's interesting to think about why cooling the burn in some cases, for smaller burns, can provide some pain relief in addition to perhaps for smaller burns limiting the effect of the local inflammation. And my understanding about, I call it gate control theory. There's different monikers for that. But if you think about the ascending neural pathways, the sensory neurons, I think of it as the Wi-Fi router bandwidth. So there's only a limited amount of bandwidth available. And if I am flooding those ascending sensory nerves with temperature sensation, there's less room bandwidth available for nociception or pain reception. So it kind of doesn't take away the pain, but it kind of blocks it out by flooding those receptors with cold sensation, if you will. So I think it's useful to realize that's in the mix, even though it may not be my reason for cooling this patient in this case, but patients may respond to that and it can make the water muddy in terms of why we're doing this. So anyway, long story short, I'd like to cool the burn, but especially for larger burns, I want to be very careful to switch gears sooner rather than later, within a matter of minutes, to actively doing everything I can to keep them warm. If I have active warming, yes, but at least actively, if I can use this phrase, anti-cooling, right? I may not be able to warm them, but I can do everything I can to prevent them from getting more cold than they already are.
How do you do that? How do you prevent that heat loss?
Yeah, great question. Well, it depends on who you are, when you are, and where you are. I would say even if it's, you know, me and my buddy in a truck, number one, I can cover them with, you know, burn sheets, burn dressings, whatever. Then I've probably got my Mylar blanket to make them look like a baked potato, right? You know, put that foil blanket on them, perhaps. Even if I'm not in hospital, I can turn the heat up in the back of the ambulance all the way up. Those are probably the tools that are most readily accessible. And I would say being mindful of not leaving them uncovered for longer than I have to. I'll tell on me in the burn center. I see this often in a trauma bay or in the burn center where we'll get direct admissions. We leave them naked an awfully long time, just looking at them, you know, and I've got everything exposed in front of God and everybody. But I could, if I'm worried about hypothermia, I can look at, well, left arm while everything else is covered, or right arm while everything else is covered, and do that piecewise while trying to keep core temp from dropping further. If it's a kid, younger kids, neonates especially, they can lose huge quantities of heat from their heads, you know, 40% of their heat energy coming out of their head. So even if their head isn't burned, doing everything I can to cover that head so that they don't have heat loss, unnecessary radiant heat loss from that, so to speak. So keeping them covered as much as possible, using the thermostat up, turning the HVAC up. If I'm in an ED setting, sure, bust out the, we call it jokingly, the French fry warmer. You know, if I have a radiant heater, I have the luxury of warmed fluids. We don't want to use a rapid infuser, but if I can warm my fluids, that's all to the good. The how will differ tactically, depends on who you are, but just lean into doing it as much as possible. I make one other joke here. It's worth trotting out. Even if you're in the truck, you know, turning the heat up, and I like to say the rule of thumb is about 5 to 7 minutes. If by 5 to 7 minutes into the ride or into the treatment of this patient, if you don't have the first few trickles of swamp butt, then the temperature's not set up high enough, I would argue.
Let's say our patient is less than 20%. Mm-hmm. So we're in the back of that ambulance. We flew in a helicopter. They show us this patient. They're less than 20% total body surface area. No airway involvement.
Sure.
No potential for a shock of another cause, you know, a traumatic cause. Are there any burns that it's like, oh, yep, that's a trump card, needs to go to the burn center?
Yeah, great question. So referral criteria, so the ABA has 10 that say these are reasons you would want to consult with the burn center, and I'll rattle off those 10. So going back to depth of injury, if I'm third degree of any size, we think you should consult with the burn center. Now, again, I say consult because let's agree 40% full thickness burn is one thing. Having a third degree burn the size of a nickel, I'm like, okay, that's different. But let's at least, you know, maybe it's on a joint, on my face, on, you know, functional or cosmetic important real estate, if you will. So third degree, we definitely want, that needs to be a consultation, probable transfer. Depends on, again, does the patient have other things going on, whatever. Second degree, 10% or greater. So if it's a 10% second degree or greater, yes, we still want you to consult with consideration for transfer. So those are what I call garden variety burns, classical burns. After that, I call the next three the bougies. Bougie burns. And again, you won't find that in a textbook. That's my made-up title.
I like it. It should be in a textbook.
We do what we could. Well, that's why they don't let me write my textbooks. So this is the non-traditional stuff, or the stuff that has the potential for more than meets the eye. So that's, is it electrical, chemical, or inhalation? So those are three where it may not be a huge, obvious TBSA, but the potential risk to the patient can still be quite high. So the three bougies, not to be confused with, you know, my airway tool, the three of those added to my first two, which were based solely on depth and size. So again, to recap, third degree of any size, second degree, 10% or greater, the three bougies, if you will, chemical, electrical, and inhalation. Then we move on to, well, what else? Well, if this is a polytrauma, meaning they have some other kind of trauma and a burn, well, this is going to be more complicated.
Maybe so, some sort of fiery car accident.
Yeah, classic case, right? Sure. The MVC, where they're breathing in smoke, took a while to extricate, so they've got flame burn, and then liver lag, busted pelvis, flail, whatever. Or house fire, and they got out of the house, but it was by jumping from the second story window, whatever that might be. So the caveat to that one, just to put it out there, when those, they're a trauma and a burn, the assumption is that the burn piece of the equation is trumping the trauma piece of the equation. If the classical trauma aspect is the greater threat to life, then our triage should be to the closest trauma center. Then I, you know, adhere to my trauma guidelines. Well, let's stabilize that liver lack. Let's stabilize whatever it is. Then we can do a secondary triage when it's appropriate to get you to a burn center. So that's six criteria. Seventh criteria, if they have extensive premorbidities, because let's agree that a minor burn, or you or I, healthy, youngish folks, very different if you're 85 and you have all of the things. So minor burns may not be minor for you. Okay, so what's next? Kids, right? So we know kids by definition are gonna, you know, be trickier. So pediatric burns, we want you to consult if your facility's not able to handle those needs that kids are gonna have. And then the special, well, okay, the kind of the catch-all. You're going to need the longer rehabilitation, the, you know, behavioral health issues, substance abuse, all these extra things that are going to, you're going to need the wraparound services that a burn center would be able to provide.
What about, I've heard, it's kind of EMS or paramedic folklore about burning functional areas being incredibly critical. Hands and fingers.
Sure.
Joint spaces.
Yeah.
What is there any truth behind that?
Oh, absolutely. Because, well, let's agree that you want to survive the injury, and which is a great start. So it's the beginning of the story, not the end. So we want you to have, you know, be able to use your hands to type on your computer, or, you know, to bend your elbow to flex it so you can wash your hair, or whatever it is. So the long-term outcomes, that's where we want the wraparound services. It's not just surviving the injury, having a surgeon of some kind close the wound, but it's long-term functional and cosmetic outcomes, and that's going to require OT, PT, skilled nursing care for days, weeks, months, etc. All those additional pieces. So that would be a reason to send to a burn center versus the closest trauma center who could patch him up, but might not be happy with that result a year from now.
Gotcha. But I think one caveat would be, depending on where you work, definitely consult your protocol. There might be a cutoff for you, local facility versus some, what I'm thinking is some places getting to the burn center is, you know, over the river and through the woods and on a flight and in a helicopter and on a boat or whatever. So some places I know do have guidelines locally for what should start locally, then progress further versus be transferred out from the field. But again, we're talking about some of those grayer areas, perhaps.
Sure. No, it's a useful point. So, and to be clear, so the ABA makes recommendations and say, these are our criteria. We think that you can consult, but it's not really directive in the sense of that an EMS agency in Denver, as an example, or South Orange Rescue Squad or whatever, they're not beholden to, they don't answer to the ABA. So they follow whatever their medical directors are. They are bound by whatever the local transfer and affiliation agreements are. So there's the local politics. Where does the ABA guidelines come in? Well, number one, I mean, it should inform those discussions at the senior leadership level. But kind of on a related note, I mean, I've had good conversations, let's say, with other air care flight paramedics or whatever, who, you know, if I'm picking up the scene call and I've got the closest trauma center is, you know, 37 minutes away, but I can get to I'm picking UNC because that's where I work, but if I can get to UNC and it's 43 minutes away, it's 5 minutes further, but they're also a trauma center, but that's the definitive dispo for the burn piece of their polytrauma plus burn, then that's part of the calculus, right? And so that might mean, you know, where do I want to send this asset, etc. So it's a shifting calculus.
For sure. I would love to, this is a whole separate thing. I would love to do a whole episode on electrical. And I know I've also heard you have blown my mind on hydrofluoric acid too, which is really cool.
I thought you were going to say blow your mind on electrical. And I thought, nice pun. Well played, sir. It's a good dad joke. I hope that makes the cut.
So perhaps to the listeners, maybe stay tuned for some deep dives into those topics. But
absolutely.
Can you give us the wave tops of electrical and what makes that unique?
Sure.
And maybe some pitfalls there within.
Yeah. So one of the reasons that electrical, you know, makes the squad for the bougie injuries here is that, you know, the way that we phrase it is you are almost guaranteed to get to have further tissue injury beyond what is visible, beyond the obvious cutaneous quote-unquote burn. So there's myriad mechanisms of injury with current passing through human tissue. So there's the thermal piece of this. There's also a concept called, and this is just a teaser, electroporation, which opens the gated channels in the cell membranes. So current does that, and when you send lots of current, this is like every Prison Break movie you've ever seen, where, you know, the inmates get into the guardhouse and they turn the thing and all of cell block D, every door opens at the same time. That's my goofy metaphor version of what electroporation is. It just means that all your gated channels open, which means all your concentration gradients are jacked up, and so you have cell lysis. That's unrelated to the thermal piece of the puzzle. So it's not going to look like first, second, and third degree because it's not thermal insult, that piece of it. So you may have tissue injury unrelated or that doesn't look like a traditional flame burn. And then you think about, well, what are the specialized structures that exist in human tissue that are really well designed for carrying current? Oh, wait a minute, that's like action potential. Oh, wait, so nerves. Oh, wait, so that's like the PNS and the CNS and the cardiac conduction system. So these kinds of patients can have acute or chronic, you know, nervous system changes, or what will really get your attention is the cardiac conduction system changes with a lethal arrhythmia. That'll get everybody's attention, their V-fib, whatever, but new onset heart block, for example, or wow, this is really a boutique rhythm that I see in front of me. So the moral of the story, if electricity is involved at all, then look beyond the surface for additional injuries that could be catastrophic and life-threatening before the thermal insult ever has a chance to weigh in.
Gotcha. Before we recap mm-hmm. some of the pearls that you've given us, I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug a little bit of the great work you guys do at UNC, at the J.C. Byrne Center. How many patients annually do you guys see there?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And to be fair, there are lots of great burn centers out there. We are proud to do great work, and we love our brothers and sisters in the burning community everywhere who are all fighting the good fight. But the J.C. Byrne Center at UNC Medical Center, we've been around since February of 1981, so we've been doing this for a while. Every year is a little different, but the last few years we've been admitting, like inpatient admissions, around 1,200 admissions. What most people don't know, we've had an additional 4,000 or 5,000 outpatient clinic visits. So that's another tool for patients to be aware of. I don't need to go to the hospital to stay, but I might want expert eyes to look at it. Then you can come to our clinic Monday through Friday and have provider eyes, nursing eyes, OT eyes to help you get the best possible outcomes. Another kind of arrow in our quiver, if you will, is what's called aftercare. So what we know is for patients to have long-term good outcomes, they need support for the neck up, if you will, the psychosocial piece, their mental health, their connectedness, being able to know that they're not the only one that this has happened to, that they have a family to support them. So our aftercare programs are designed to support survivors, and we choose that term very specifically. They're burn survivors, not just victims, but they're survivors, and we want them to thrive thereafter. But we have programs to support, could be weekend programs, for example. What we call our cherry on top or the crown jewel is Camp Celebrate. It's the oldest pediatric burn camp in the country. We've been doing that 43 years now. So it's a chance for burn kids to be around other burn kids. We have programs for adults, for families, for teens. So that's part of the puzzle too, and it gives a way for the entire burn family to come together. Now, I'll give you a specific case. Before coming here today, I drove to Pittsburgh. Drove down to Pittsburgh to receive like an entire truckload of donations for our aftercare programs. The donation was from the Chatham County Firefighter Burn Children's Fund. So a good portion of what we do as a burn center is our staff, but we couldn't do it without fire service volunteers, private donors from across the state, across the country, to support what we do to give optimal outcomes, optimal support to survivors and families for the long haul, for as long as they need it.
That's awesome.
Derek, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This has been an amazing episode, just packed full of great pearls and pathophysiology and breaking down what is happening with these, you know, if we're being honest, scary patients to us in the pre-hospital setting. If I can just real quick wrap up what I gained from this lecture, kind of the take-home points that I saw, and then I'll let you kind of correct me or fill in what I missed. But first and foremost in these patients is we want to look out for kind of the three immediate life threats, and that's airway. We want to make sure that their airway is secure, that it's not swelling, that they're not going to lose their airway. We want to look out for any other polytrauma that might have happened. We want to look out for inhalation injuries. This includes injury to the alveolar tissue or even inhalation such as cyanide and carbon monoxide poisoning if the patient was, say, trapped in a burning building. And we have episodes on each one of those inhalations previously, so refer to those for more on those topics. Once we've assured that none of these three immediate life threats are happening, then we can move on to exposing the patient completely and getting a gross estimate, realizing that it's nothing more than an estimate of how much total body surface area is burned. You can use the rule of nines, which is going to be easy if it's like, say, a circumferential burn of an entire extremity, but it's going to become more difficult if it's more patchy, in which case you're probably going to want to use something like the palmar surface area to calculate that burn area. And specifically what we're talking about, we're not doing first degree burns. That just red skin doesn't count. We're looking for blistering or worse, skin that doesn't blanch, skin that's leathery, skin that's eschar. That is what counts in our calculations. Once we've calculated that, forget math. If you've listened to this show for any period of time, you know how much we hate math on this show. And I'm so happy to hear you say this. Keep it simple. 500 cc's per hour if they're an adult. If they're 6 to 13, it's going to be 250 cc's per hour. And if they're 5 or less, it's going to be 125 cc's per hour. What this means is if you've contacted that patient in the first hour and you're going to be at the hospital within an hour, you're not going to dump an entire liter into this patient. We're not giving a whole bunch of fluids up front to these patients. They need fluids, but they don't need us to flood them. If they're hypotensive, they may need fluids, but if they're hypotensive in that first hour, you got to think about those other causes: cyanide poisoning, polytrauma, something else that might be killing them, because that burn shock is going to develop over hours. And then finally, the last piece of the puzzle that's really important is we're going to want to prevent any heat loss during that transport. Cover them with blankets, crank that heat in the back of the ambulance, prevent that heat loss because they just lost that skin barrier if it's a critical large burn. Derek, what did I miss?
These are great points, Ross. Appreciate that. The last thing that I'd like to add, even if you've done the maths, right, if you've done a fantastic estimate of the size and depth of the burn, every patient is a little different. They may have premorbidities we don't know about. Maybe they were already dehydrated, for example. Maybe they have a cardiac history and they can't handle excessive fluids. So don't be afraid to go off the reservation and keep your eyes on your patient. There's always situations where our estimates, our TBSA may be spot on, where our estimate of depth is spot on, and we did the maths correctly, but it's wrong for this patient. So I'd say no cookie cutter formula is good for the long haul. Now, the 125, 250, 500, it's great for my load and go to get something going, but over the first 24 hours, if I'm sitting on this patient for longer, if this is, again, MCIs or longer transport times or whatever.
Austere environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we, you know, austere environment, we talking Kandahar, or are we talking, you know, Pacific Northwest, where I've got to go a long way to get to a, you know, another burn center, whatever it may be. You have to be willing. I think of the formulas as rumble strips and not guardrails. If the patient is showing me this is, I need more than this, or this is too much, I have to be willing to follow the patient, what they're showing me, based on myriad of factors, urine output, vital signs, all those things. So I don't think I said that enough, because the last thing I want is for folks to be married to, you know, doing this formula, whatever the number is, come hell or high water, because that can lead to problems. Follow where the patient leads you with their response to your treatments. So, and then, you know, titrate, modify your treatment as needed, but let your patient guide you to what they need based on their response to what you're doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
That's great. I love it.